A creature alive today has survived millions of years of evolution. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine that will attack and devour anything. One terrified you like nothing you have ever experienced when it captured your imagination and tapped your fear like no movie before it. Then, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, two continued the legend and spread the fear. Next summer, nature's most terrifying creature takes on an all-new dimension in an all-new adventure. And for the first time, the terror of Jaws will not stop at the edge of the screen. Jaws 3D, the third dimension, is terror.
And welcome to Unloved Sequels, the podcast that brings you a blow-by-blow critique of Hollywood's worst-rated sequels. You know, the ones that some people think should never have been made. We're your hosts. Michael, say hello.
Hello.
And I'm Claire. In this episode, the third dimension is terror. Or is it just terrible movie making? Michael, we're revisiting one of your favourite movie franchises, but having already covered the good sequel, we are now left plunging into murky waters, literally, for the third instalment. What's the movie?
Yes, Claire, we're back into the deep water. But this time we're heading down to the Sunshine State of Florida and stepping into the third dimension to toy with Baby Shark, do-do-do-do-do-do, Baby Shark,
do-do-do-do-do-do.
Baby Shark, do 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 do. And then 60 minutes later, we go have a fun with Mommy Shark, do 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 do. Mommy Shark, do 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 do. Mommy Shark, do 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 do. Yes, guys.
You know, we're recording this in the evening for me in London, which means I'm going to be singing that in my sleep. You've got the rest of the day to get that song out of your head. And also, you don't have small children, so it doesn't get stuck in your head in quite the same way as it does with mine. So, yeah, thanks for that.
The Jaws 3 opened on the July 22nd, 1983. Fun fact, this was Joseph Sargent's birthday, who went on to direct Jaws Revenge. So I thought...
Yes. I was just thinking I recognise that name.
His birthday. Yes. And then he got given the job to direct the fourth one 4 years later. Who would have thought? Well, wow. 3 years later.
Well, they weren't going to give this guy the job, were they?
No. It grossed $88 million against a budget of $18 million. Adjusted for inflation, that's just under $266 million. But I also thought it'd be fun to look at the budget adjusted for inflation. That was $18 million. And today that'd be like $55 million. Well, I don't think what they're trying to achieve with this movie, they would have to, today's world, they'd have to spend like $150 million.
They would, but it would probably look better.
This is very true.
If they made this movie with that budget, they would get this movie, I think.
Yes. Oh, yeah, 100%. So looking at the charts, most of the charts only hold Jaws 3's domestic box office figure. So looking at the US box office of 1983, Jaws came in at number 16.
Okay.
It was a big jump. Jaws being the biggest film of all time.
Oh, well, yes. Yes.
Jaws 2 being the biggest sequel of all time at that time. It's a massive step down.
Yeah, okay.
So the top grossing movies domestically this week in 1983 as follows. Starting at number 10 and working up, we have Risky Business with Tom Cruise.
Oh, I love that film.
Good film. Mr. Mum with Michael Keaton.
Mm-hmm.
Staying Alive with John Travolta. Sudden Impact, when I haven't got a clue what that movie is.
I've heard of it. I think it's a disaster movie, but I haven't seen it, I don't think.
I haven't got a clue. Octopussy, that James Bond film.
Yeah.
War Games with Matthew Broderick, I believe. Great movie. Absolutely classic.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that.
Oh, my God, it's such a good movie.
Oh, I'll look it up.
Trading Places with Dan Aykroyd.
Love that movie.
Flashdance with Bill. Forgotten her first name now.
Jennifer.
No, I'm
Jessica.
Bill, that's it.
Jennifer.
Yes, Jennifer. Jennifer. Jennifer Bill. Terms of Endearment at number two with Shirley MacLaine.
Mm-hmm.
And number one was Star Wars: The Return of the Jedi.
Of course it was.
A period of time was always a Star Wars movie. But this was also the year where we got Superman 3.
Mm-hmm.
If you guys haven't listened to that episode, go back and search.
You're in for a treat.
It last year, or you are. And maybe in a future episode, Never Say Never Again, that James Bond film that Sean Connery came back.
The James Bond film that isn't a James Bond film, but it's a James Bond film, but it's not a James Bond film. Isn't it? Like, it's not officially. Tagline. Yeah, that's basically, like, that's the one that's not officially a James Bond film, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah. So it's a James Bond film that isn't a James Bond film, but it's got James Bond in it with Sean Connery as James Bond in a film that isn't a James Bond film.
Tubby Broccoli sold a book to Sony and they made Never Say Never Again. But I think it'd be quite interesting to cover that one day because it's got Kim Basinger in it as a James Bond girl.
Mm. So I don't think I've ever seen it.
I have never seen it either.
I feel like you're cheating on James Bond. To be fair, he probably cheated on you first, so...
He probably did.
Let's put it on the list.
And a very underrated sequel, Psycho 2, that I freaking adore. That it has a massive fan base now, but at the time didn't do very well. It currently, Jaws 3 currently sits at 1,946 in the worldwide box office of all time, behind 1991's remake of Father of the Bride.
Okay.
It also sits at 469 of the all-time sequel box office. It opened in 1,300 theatres in the US and had an average of a 4 weeks run per theatre. So it wasn't out there for a very long time.
It's not long, is it? I mean, for 1983, though, is that a long run or is it not? Obviously, we weren't watching movies in cinemas in 1983. I don't know what was considered a long run.
I don't know. I imagine if it's successful, the marketplace wasn't flooded. I feel like we've lived through where Hollywood, big blockbusters were just starting off in the 80s.
Mm.
And then in the late 70s, early 80s, and then in the 90s, everybody was at the movie theatre every weekend, so it got overflooded. And now due to COVID, it's gone back to a very slow procedure. And also with streaming, people make more things for streaming now. So I think we've lived at the top end and the bottom end of Hollywood. I feel like our lifespan has been really weird when it comes to look at the Hollywood aspect of things. Universal Studios Home Entertainment didn't release Jaws in the 3D format for home release until 2016. So everybody just watched it in 2D.
It was on the Blu-ray release, wasn't it?
It was on the Blu-ray. Shoved under special features on the same disc, so the pitch quality in both versions is awful.
But you need to have a 3D Blu-ray player and a 3D TV. You need the special equipment. You can't just buy the DVD, buy the Blu-ray and watch it in 3D.
Yeah, they've never officially released an analog 3D version. It's always got to be done with active or passive 3D.
Mm.
So Rotten Tomato currently sits at 11% critics and 17% audience.
Mm.
Just for comparison, Jaws 2 was 61% critics and audience was 39%. And Jaws of Revenge is 0% critics and 15% audience.
But then the original Jaws movie was 97% critics.
Yes.
And I'm just scrolling through my notes to find it. 90% audience for first movie. So this is the drop off.
I would like to go and find those people that gave it less marks just to bitch slap them, because that film is like the holy grail of filmmaking for me.
What, the 3% of people who didn't like Jaws? Yeah.
Where are you?
Make yourself what are you seen. Thinking? The work of genius. This
just one quick
however...
backhander. Just one quick backhander. So, Claire, do you have any behind the scenes stuff for us?
I do, yes. So, Looking first of all at the cast and creative team, normally at this point I tell you which cast members have carried through from previous installments of a franchise. There are none. There is no one in this movie who has appeared in a previous Jaws movie. We do have two characters carry through. We see Mike Brody, we see Sean Brody, but they are both being played by new actors for the third time. There are no two movies in the installment where the Brody brothers are played by the same actor more than once. So in this movie, we have Dennis Quaid playing Mike Brody. We have Bess Armstrong as his girlfriend, Catherine Morgan. We've got Simon McCorkindale as Philip Fitzroyce. We've got Louis Gossett Jr. as Calvin Bouchard, who is the kind of he's the manager of SeaWorld. Interestingly, he came into the production on this off the back of winning an Oscar for An Officer and a Gentleman. And then
get this for winning an Oscar.
I know. And then got Razzie nominated for this back to back award seasons. I mean, it could be that he'd signed up to this before he got his award, but he received the award before he started work on the film. We've got John Putch as Sean Brody, and we've got Leah Thompson in her first movie role as Kelly Bukowski. Leah Thompson, movie geeks will know, plays
Marty McFly's mum in
Back Marty McFly's Future. Mum. Yes, I don't even know why I made that sound like a quiz. You're looking at me like, what the fuck? Like, you know, this.
You know who I am.
Worst pop quiz ever. Yes. Anyway, so Leah Thompson in her first movie role. The movie is directed by Joe Alvers, who has no other movie directing credits, but he was production designer on Jaws and Jaws 2, and also Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Escape from New York. So he had worked in the industry a lot prior to this. This is his first directing gig, and he was never given another one. I can't think why. The story was written by... The story credit is given to Gordon Trueblood. The screenplay was by Richard Matheson, although Richard Matheson claims to have written the original treatment. And Carl Gottlieb also worked on the screenplay. He did screenplay work also on Jaws and Jaws 2.
He's also in Jaws and Jaws 2.
Who, Carl Gottlieb?
Yeah, he's got a sub-acting role as a news reporter in both those movies.
Ah, nice. Keeping it in the family. Keeping it cheap.
Is the only one? Yeah, keeping it cheap, I think, is the wrong point.
Saves paying two people. He's already on set. Yes. The music was composed by Alan Parker, who, again, doesn't have very many movie credits. He went on to write the music for What's Eating Gilbert Grape. He has got quite an extensive CV, but it's mostly British TV work. He's a British composer, and he's done a lot of TV stuff, but not so many movies. Now, in terms of how we came to get this movie in the first place, David Brown and Richard Zanuck, who were the producers on the first two films, originally pitched a second Jaws sequel as a spoof, and it was going to be called Jaws 3 People Zero. And it was going to be very kind of National Lampoon style. They brought in Matty Simmons, who was producer of National Lampoon's Animal House. He was brought in to produce, and then Brown and Zanuck were going to take on executive producer roles. Simmons had outlined a story and commissioned the writers from National Lampoon, John Hughes and Todd Carroll, to do a script. And Joe Dante was very briefly pursued as director. He had directed The Howling in 1981. He went on to direct Gremlins, The Burbs, Gremlins 2, Small Soldiers. He's got quite a long CV behind him. The project was then shut down because of conflicts with Universal Studios. I think they weren't keen on the whole spoof angle. David Brown later said in the Making of Jaws 2 DVD documentary, which I think is a feature on the DVD copy, that the studio's attitude was that the spoof would have been a mistake. He was quoted as saying, "It would be like fouling in your own nest. We should have fouled the nest. It would have been golden, maybe even platinum." So he was clearly quite keen on still pursuing that spoof angle.
Yeah.
But the studio was not, so it got kiboshed. Then Alan Landsberg, who, again, there's not many theatrical credits for him. He's made a lot of TV movies, including The Parent Trap 2, which I didn't know existed. But now that I know it exists, I feel like it probably deserves to be on our list for a future episode.
Yeah. But what year was Parent Trap 2 made? Was it to a sequel to the Lindsay Lohan?
No. This is pre-Lindsay Lohan.
So it's the sequel to the Jodie Foster?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it doesn't look great, but we, yeah, maybe we'll cover it sometime. I don't know. Anyway, so Alan Landsberg bought the rights to produce the film. So he tried to get Murray Lerner involved in Jaws 3. He was quite an experimental director. He had done a 3D short film called Sea Dream in 1978. So he tried to get him involved in the production. But when Lerner received the first script, he said his heart sank and he said, I can't really get involved in this. And so he didn't like the script. The production already had an art director. So Lerner stepped back and declined to be involved. So ultimately, the film was directed by Joe Alves. As I said, he was production designer for the first two films and was second unit director for Jaws 2. So he was quite well versed in the industry. Cheap, maybe. He knew the brand, he knew the product, he knew how to make a good film, you would think. He certainly knew how to make a film look good, but I guess he didn't quite absorb as much from working with more esteemed directors as Universal might have hoped when they gave him the job, because he clearly doesn't have that level of directing skill, I think it's fair to say, from the fact that he was never offered another directing job again. I don't think this is me speaking out of turn.
I'm not sure if he wanted one. I think he realized the output.
Maybe not. Maybe after he made this, he was like, do you know what? This isn't my skill set. Because he carried on working. It's not like he got blacklisted after this movie. I think he just thought, well, actually, this isn't what I'm good at. I'm going to go back to what I'm clearly better at, and fair play to him.
Yeah, no, I agree.
As with the first two films in the series, there were lots of writers involved in this film. Richard Matheson, who'd written the script for Steven Spielberg's 1971 television film Jewel, said that he wrote a very interesting outline, although the story, he said, is credited to some other writer, presumably Gerdon Trueblood, but I don't know. But the original premise that Matheson wrote was that a great white had swum upstream and got trapped in a lake. And then that somehow got twisted and rehashed and rewritten and bastardized into The Shark is Stuck at SeaWorld.
Swim up a lane and where's the SeaWorld?
It's a bit of a stretch. Universal forced Matheson to write in the two Brody sons, which didn't make sense to Matheson because it wasn't set in Amity. There was no real connection to that family anymore. But they said they wanted to see Mike and Sean Brody back in the movie. So he did it. They also wanted it to be the same shark in Jaws 3 that had been electrocuted at the end of Jaws 2. Now that didn't end up, yes, your face is like, but that was quite conclusively fried shark at the end.
Yeah. His eyes were on fire and smoke.
Yes. So that didn't happen in Jaws 3. They didn't carry that through. Matheson was also requested to write a role specifically for Mickey Rooney, which he did. And then Mickey Rooney wasn't available.
Jesus. Is that the guy at the beginning?
I don't know. I've been trying to find out which part might have been Mickey Rooney's. It could be that the part got cut. I don't know. But anyway, by the time they'd been through all of this, Richard Matheson was pretty pissed off and did not particularly like the end result when he saw the movie. No. He's not ever so keen. He did an interview in Tom Weaver's snappily titled book, Science Fiction Stars and Horror Heroes, Interviews with Actors, Directors, Producers and Writers of the 1940s through 1960s. I know, it's the longest book title in the history of books.
Thank God, anyway. I don't work in bookshops anymore. Can you imagine?
You got a copy of Science Fiction Stars and Horror Heroes, Interviews with Actors, Directors, Producers, Writers of the 1940s through 1960s? Why are you asleep, sir? Anyway.
And your name, Jay?
Tom Weaver. Anyway, Matheson was interviewed for this book. And in the interview, he said, I'm a good storyteller and I wrote a good outline and a good script. And if they'd done it right, and if it had been directed by somebody who knew how to direct, I think it would have been an excellent movie. Jaws 3D was the only thing Joe Alves ever directed. The man is a very skilled production designer, but as a director, no. And the so-called 3D just made the film look murky. It had no effect whatsoever. It was a waste of time. So he's not pulling any punches about this movie, and he wrote the damn thing.
He feels quite passionate about this, doesn't he?
Yes, he is not keen. There were no actors carrying forward from the previous films, as I mentioned. They did try and get Roy Scheider. Apparently,
again?
He took on... I know. Apparently, he signed on to do Blue Thunder, basically to make sure he couldn't be available for Jaws 3D. He took another job so that they couldn't try and kind of strong-arm him into being in this movie. But Dennis Quaid was in the movie. Dennis Quaid said in an interview in 2015 that out of all of his films, he made the most aggressive use of cocaine during the filming of Jaws 3D, and that he was high on the drug in every frame in which he appears. He also
claimed recently, and this was like last year, I think, claimed recently that back in the day, cocaine was flowing so freely that a lot of the film's budgets were to supply the cast with cocaine. And they said, which film had the most horrific amount of cocaine? He was like, I was thinking I was making a third about some kind of fish or something. He wouldn't say it. But he was like, was he footing around saying Jaws 3? He goes, there was just cocaine everywhere. Everybody was just stoned. He goes, I was coked off my face through a majority of filming Jaws 3D.
And to be fair, if that is true, he did a damn good job. I think he's quite good in this, but I mean, maybe the bar is just low because of everything else about the movie. I quite like him in this, but
he's also quite easy on the eye, Claire, during this.
He is quite easy on the eye. Yes. Young Dennis Quaid is quite, I mean, you know, current day Dennis Quaid is, you wouldn't kick him out, but anyway.
He got together with Leah Thompson on the set.
Oh, did he?
Of this film. Yeah, they dated for a while.
That's sweet. I mean, it's a bit weird because she was playing his brother's girlfriend, but, you know, that's fine. And to be fair, she isn't in half the movie anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
No.
So this film was made, as we know, in 3D. It also had a 2D theatrical release, and obviously they revised the name to Jaws 3 rather than they just took the D out. But because of the processes that are involved, because it was filmed in 3D, there was no 2D version to release. So basically, I'm a bit sketchy on how 3D technology works, so I'm going to explain it in my idiot level terms, and if I'm wrong, then I apologize to our listeners. But my understanding is that for 3D, certainly at this point in time, they use two cameras, one for the left eye, one for the right eye. And then they superimpose the two images to make the 3D movie. Because it was only ever filmed in 3D in that format, for the 2D release, they just used the left eye recording and scrapped the right eye recording, which is why when we watch it now in 2D, because most of us have to watch it in 2D because we don't have 3D equipment to watch it at home, and it's only on that one release you can watch it in 3D anyway. That's why everything looks a little bit out of focus, and the edges around a lot of the shapes and people and outlines are all a bit like, you can almost see the line where the colour would be. I mean, it's not colour, but you see what I mean? Like, it just looks like it's not quite lined up properly. So that's why it looks a little bit weird in 2D, and the color palette looks a little bit off as well because of the way that it was rendered down into 2D. And it sometimes, you will have noticed, I'm sure, watching it, that some of the what I guess they would call money shots for the 3D process in 2D, they look really weird because it's almost, the perspective's almost distorted because it's been shot in such a way as to make it look really good in 3D. And so then when they render it down into 2D, it just looks a little bit weird. And obviously they were leaning really hard into the popularity of 3D from the early 80s.
The previous year we had, previous year there was Friday the 13th Part 3 in 3D.
Yeah.
And Amity 3 in 3D. It seemed to be something that worked along with when there's a third film in the series. You made it in 3D in the
Well, because it's an easy little marketing thing, isn't it? Because you can call it 3D. Now, the thing that I found really, like I say, I'm not an expert on 3D movies and 3D movie making, but I got really confused because in my mind there is this kind of classic image. Anytime you watch a movie in which people go and see a 3D movie, they do like a pan shot of the auditorium and everyone's sitting there with their red and blue glasses on. And so in my mind, I had this really strong image of Jaws 3. And it must be completely made up because I was 3 when this movie came out. And it was only that you could only watch it in 3D at the cinema. And clearly I did not go and see it at age 3 in the cinema. And even if I had, I wouldn't remember. But I feel like I've got this really strong image of people watching it in the kind of anaglyph 3D format with the red and blue lines and the red and blue color glasses that go with. But through my research, I found that that's not what happened at all. It was more like the current version of. So you know more about this. I'm going to let you pick this up.
Well, actually, I'm not going to talk about it at all. I'm going to hand it over to someone that I interviewed this week. I've had a chance to sit down with a guy called Mike Ballou, who's a 3D historian.
Ooh.
So let's give that a listen.
Yeah, let's ask him. Roll the tape.
Hi, I'm here with Mike Ballou, a 3D historian and author of the upcoming book, Close Enough to Touch, 3D Comes to Hollywood. Welcome, Mike.
Hi, thanks for having me, Michael.
It's so great that you could be here. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Oh, you bet. It's my pleasure.
Excellent. Mike, can you tell us about the introduction of 3D into movies?
I can tell you quite a lot. There's a lot I know, and there's plenty we're all still discovering. But, you know, the earliest experiments with 3D in motion pictures actually seem to go back as far, according to some sources, as far as 1889. But definitely during the course of the 1890s, there was a lot of experimentation being done. And then in June 1915, very famously, there was some anaglyphic 3D footage that was presented in New York. And some people kind of pegged that as the first, perhaps because it was exhibited publicly. And it doesn't have a formal title, but a lot of folks, because some of the footage came from a play called Jim the Penman, you sometimes see it called Jim the Penman in books and things. But there's a long history of it. And even outside the United States, all countries around the world, the French were particularly advanced, it is said, and other nations as well. So it goes back quite a long ways.
Oh, that's amazing. So when it came to 3D, when it was first introduced, they used to put two cameras next to each other and run two rolls of film at the same time. Is that correct?
Yes, that is generally correct. Yes.
And how did we move from that kind of 3D into the 3D that we see today?
Well, it's funny because some of the 3D we see today, as for instance with the Avatar pictures, those are still shot with two cameras, if you can believe it, two adjacent cameras, and sometimes with very sophisticated optical trains so that they can modify the image just how they like it. But there were some sophisticated optics earlier, for instance in the 1950s as well. But so it depends on the filmmaker. It depends on what their needs are. You can shoot with two cameras. Sometimes there's a really sensible one camera approach. And of course, in recent years, we've all seen the rise and development of conversions, where they use computer technology to convert a 2D image into stereo, which that can be pretty remarkable.
So tell me about the 3D being used in horror films.
Expect you might mean especially the horror films in the early 1980s.
Yes,
and,
please.
And if we look at the resurgence of 3D at that time, it's because there had come to the market some practical methods of putting the left and right pictures on one piece of film. And let me interrupt myself just briefly to explain to the audience, in case they don't know, in order to achieve a stereoscopic 3D picture, you really have to have two discrete images, one for the left eye and one for the right eye. And a lot of times inventors or filmmakers in the past and in the present have chosen to use two adjacent cameras. One captures a left eye image and one captures a right eye image. In the mid-60s and developing for about a decade thereafter, there were several people inventing means of putting the left and right pictures on one piece of film. You could shoot it with one camera and you could project it with one projector. And because enough of those processes kind of sort of matured at the same time, there got to be a lot of interest in seeing how they could be applied to movies. And in the early 80s, I think it just seemed a natural to combine three dimensions with horror. And it occurs to me to add, there had been a very, very successful picture, Andy Warhol's Frankenstein, as it's known in the USA, Flesh for Frankenstein, I think, in the rest of the world. I'm sure somebody will set me straight if I've got that slightly wrong.
I always will.
But that was... that was filmed in space vision it was filmed in 73, released in 74, and tremendous success. And maybe that was at the back of everyone's mind come 1981, 82, 83. It just seemed a natural, like, hand in glove fit. Hey, if we're going to make a picture in three dimensions, why don't we make a horror picture?
When it comes to projecting 3D within a movie theater / cinema, how do they go ahead and do that? Does it take two projectors, or do they now just put it into one projection?
It's good that you should ask that, because there's more than one method. In the 1950s, you know, for better or for worse, actually mostly for worse, the technique was to run two synchronized projectors.
Wow.
And there's a lot of difficulties involved in that. And one of the benefits of these latter day single strip methods that I just described is that you could project the whole thing with one projector. But it required some kind of a special optical attachment. Some of the fancier units had two discrete lenses in one barrel, and other setups that functioned perfectly fine would just put prisms or mirrors out in front of the standard projection optics. And the purpose of these attachments is to superimpose the left and right pictures over each other and cross-polarize them. You're using polarized light so that you can select the left and right images. You can make sure that the left eye sees only the left picture, the right eye sees only the right picture. And it does seem to be a matter of some confusion out there because of some of the books that have been published over the years. It's very worth noting that all of the 3D features, English language 3D features of the 1950s, and all the theatrical English language 3D pictures of the early 1980s used polarized light. They didn't use that red and blue or red and green anaglyphic technology. Some of us are still fond of. You see that used for comic books and things like that.
Did you ever get a chance to see Jaws 3D in the cinema during that period of time?
Did I ever? In fact, I got to see it twice.
Wow.
And it's kind of, maybe it's a telling thing. I don't think you know this story. I didn't get a chance to share it previously. But the first occasion we went to see it must have been opening weekend, and the place was packed. And a lot of excited responses to all the off-the-screen effects, the fish head, the guy's arm. Yeah. Anytime they brought something forward to the screen out into the audience, there are all these screams of delight. Everybody loved it. And I don't know, it must have been a week and a half, 2 weeks later. My grandparents, my grandfather had been in the Navy, stationed in San Diego back in the 1950s. And he had made a point of seeing as many of the 1950s 3D movies as he could. And so he was very keen to come out and see Jaws 3 because he wanted to know if they had improved the technology.
Yeah.
And so the second time we went with my grandpa and slightly diminished crowd. I don't think it was quite as packed as the first time. Mm-hmm. They enjoyed it. You know, I think there were things about it that my grandfather found impressive. But he, if I'm honest with you, I don't think he liked the story as much as he did on some of the 1950s pictures.
I can imagine, especially people that grew up with the original Jaws, to see the demise in the franchise must have been quite eye-opening as well.
Yes. And not to court controversy, but some of your listeners may think it still had a ways down to go. Yes. I don't know what the consensus is, whether it's thought that Jaws the Revenge is a lesser movie than Jaws 3, but it may be that the slope was still descending.
We'll hold that for a future episode. So tell me about the book you're writing.
Well, the title is Close Enough to Touch, 3D Comes to Hollywood. And I began writing in earnest in January of 2021. And it's funny because the closer I think I'm getting to completion, the more new material surfaces that simply has to be included. And lately I have had a great deal of wonderful cooperation around the world, the National Film Board of Canada, the British Film Institute, several great universities in Europe and in North America. And ever since we reopened after the pandemic, I've had increased access to the Margaret Herrick Library, to UCLA, and lately to USC here in Los Angeles. So a lot of information is turning up that's just never been printed elsewhere. And my colleagues at the 3D Film Archive, in particular Bob Furmanek and Jack Theakston, have done a lot to dispel incorrect rumors and information by means of their website.
What period of time does the book look at within Hollywood?
Well, it's nominally looking at the period 1950 to 1975, but the reality is, in order to explain the developments circa 1952-53, one really has to go back a little ways. And so I find that I am touching on developments really going all the way back to the silent era.
Oh, wow. That's really impressive to think about them even developing and looking at 3D movies during that period of time, when you just think of the start of the start of motion picture and they're already dipping their toes into the world of 3D.
Sure. In fact, let me mention briefly, there was a man, a camera technician in the early 1950s named Friend Baker. And he was a pivotal figure in the development of 3D, and he helped to create the 3D camera rig that was used to film House of Wax.
Such a great film.
And Friend Baker, yeah, he had been dabbling in stereoscopic motion pictures since the 1920s. And it was funny because he said, he went on record as saying that he thought the only significant, truly significant development since the 1920s was the development of polarized light as an alternative to the red and blue filters. And I mentioned earlier, Friend Baker thought that the French in particular knew practically everything there was to know about stereoscopic motion pictures in the 1920s. So I like including that detail when I can. It's funny.
It's a good bit of information. So when is your book looking to come out?
Well, we're projecting a publication date of 2024 at this point.
Okay, awesome.
It's still a little bit nebulous, but we've got interest from two publishers, and they're both great publishers. And so we'll see what develops, but we're hoping about a year.
Oh, that's so good. Maybe we can have you back on to discuss one of my favorite 1950s unloved sequels, what is Revenge of the Creature. I would love to have you back on to talk about that.
I'd love to be here for it. That'd be terrific. I look forward to it.
Amazing. Now, one question we like to ask all our guests while they're on the podcast is, what is your favorite unloved sequel of all time?
You know, I'm not sure that it is truly unloved, and you'll forgive me if it's not, but Rocky IV. I love the original Rocky. Rocky may be it's definitely one of my two favorite pictures of the 1970s. Rocky IV, I think you'll agree, very kind of an unusual sequel in light of the original, the first picture. And, but by golly, is it watchable? Goodness gracious. Very watchable. It ceased being a guilty pleasure. I no longer feel the least bit guilty about watching Rocky IV. And, if there's some rare person out there listening to us who's not seen it, I'm not going to say anything more. You need to go watch it right away, immediately, today.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you for coming on the podcast today. I really appreciate the time and effort you've put into it. Thank you.
You bet. It's my pleasure, and I will be looking forward to coming back again someday soon.
So Claire, does that make it a little bit more helpful towards you?
It does. And I find that whole aspect really interesting, actually, that it genuinely blew my mind that the technology they were using in 1983 for 3D movies, and even prior to that, was the same technology that we use now.
Yeah,
I feel like I remember when 3D kind of became huge. I guess it must have been in the noughties, it wasn't as early as the late 90s. It must have been in the noughties into the 2010s.
Yes.
And it was like this amazing new innovation. It felt to me, as someone who had never experienced 3D movies in that way before, it felt like it was a brand new thing. So to find out that that's not the case at all is really interesting, and that they had that level of technology back then.
Yeah, the only movie that Mike a few times, and the only movie that he could think of that's actually used the red and green 3D that we grew up believing that we had on comic books and we had on trading cards and we had on our VHS cassettes was Freddy's Dead, the last Friday Night, Nightmare on Elm Street movie.
Mm.
Because the segment in that is only a small part of the movie, so they didn't want to run two projectors at the same time to get that effect. So we have that kind of image in our heads, because I think we just weren't exposed to a lot of 3D. Like when we were younger, it wasn't something that was in the movie theaters a lot. It was it died out quite rapidly in the early 80s and didn't come back until the, like you say, the early noughties. But yeah, no, it was a really good conversation. Thanks, Mike, for stopping by and having that conversation with me. It was really eye-opening, and I'm really looking forward to reading his book when he gets released.
Yes.
I thought it would be very fascinating.
So, on to the movie itself, Michael.
Yes.
Do you like it?
Well,
what's to like in it then? Let's not make it such a broad question. But tell me some things that you like in this movie. There must be some, other than Dennis Quaid.
It's a shark movie. It's a Jaws movie. I like it because it's a Jaws movie. I like it because it's a big shark. The problem with this movie is the concept of it is fantastic.
Yeah.
It just wasn't. Like, you look at Jaws 1, an amazing made movie. Jaws 2, they took a sidestep and made it into a slasher, and they went that route with it because it was very popular in the late 70s to have slasher movies early. And then we got into this one, and they tried to make a monster movie, but it really didn't portray that way. Like, there's some artistic shots I really like. I like it when he eats people. You got that inside the camera mouth. And the
Oh, and them crunchy bones. Those bones are so crunchy.
In the UK, they had to remove 90% of the crunchy noise because they were threatened to give a higher age rating to it. So they have an issue with blood and noise of crunching bones, apparently, in the UK. But
but we can say fuck, so...
I like Alan Parker's soundtrack. I think he does another great job. I think he really gets that essence of... He gives you that Florida theme park feel to the Jaws sound.
Yes, I mean, when I first heard it, I remember saying to you, God, it sounds like they've written Jaws the musical.
Yes, because it's got that Florida...
Because
like,
there's you know, the scoring that goes with the water skiing scenes, for example, that opening scene with the water skis in formation and the da 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 da. It's so jazz hands.
I really like it.
This is a bit of a juxtaposition. I do like it. I have to say, I think I prefer the other three scores out of the franchise. I think this would be my least favourite of the four, but I do still like it,
Yeah, I think he did a good job trying to kind of like give that bubbly, happy feel you get in Florida when you go to SeaWorld or Disney or Universal, which is that kind of like theme park sound, like when you're waiting in a queue. Doodle-doo. I really like that.
Waiting in a queue to get eaten by a shark.
Exactly. Apart from that, I just have stuff that I don't really like about it. Like, I think it's just such a wasted opportunity.
Yes.
So they've kind of like, they've tried to jump the shark in this one. Out of all the Jaws movies, this is the one that I think jumps the shark. And I just think this is the one that they tried to jump it and it just kind of like belly flopped. I just don't, I know I had to express how I feel about this movie without going on a massive 2-hour rant.
Nobody wants to hear that.
Yeah, no, like there's parts of it that I find really boring. Like the fact that the mother shark doesn't turn up for 60 minutes.
Yes. Like, yeah, they make us wait a really long time for that reveal that the shark we see is not the shark that's been doing the damage.
And then you've got this plastic shark that's in the tank that they actually, when it dies, the actress just turns it over gradually with her own hands.
I didn't spot that when I first watched it. And then you said to me, did you notice at that point? And listeners, if you didn't notice, we looked it up because Michael told me to go back and look. It's at around 59 minutes. It's when the shark, the baby shark, is in the tank. Katie realizes that the shark is distressed and jumps into the pool to try and save the shark. And there is the first time it flips and she pulls it back over, and clearly someone's like out of shot holding the shark's tail to flip it over or something. But the second time, you can just see her moving the shark herself to flip it onto its back, and then going, "Oh no, oh no, it's gone onto its back." But you did that, darling. You did that.
No offense, but even if you saw a baby shark that was in this baby great white shark in distress, your first gut instinct wouldn't be to jump in that water.
Well, it's a very passive distressed shark, I noticed.
Rubber.
It's not how I would expect a distressed shark to behave. But no. But yeah, I mean, you know, useful for her that it was so still that she could turn it over at will and yeah, not no, have it, it struggling was... with her at all.
So am I allowed to go? Do you want to say what you like before I go on a rant about what I don't like?
Yes. Yes. Let's okay, let's give it like? A little bit more credit before we completely destroy it. Yes. I think the performances are by and large good in this movie. I particularly like Louis Gossett Jr. I think out of everyone in the cast, he knows what movie he's in. Oh, and yeah. He is owning it. And he is he's chewing up the scenery, but it kind of works because that's the movie that he's in. Where the others, I mean, I don't think any of them think they're turning in Oscar-winning performances, but the others are taking it, I think, a lot more seriously than he does. I like that there is a reason for the shark attacks in this movie, that they're not completely random attacks as they were in the first two movies. You know, in this one, yeah. It's the mother shark either trying to protect her calf or trying to find her calf, which still doesn't necessarily give reason to attack lots of humans, but there is at least a bit of explanation of why it might be. I mean, there's no explanation really of how two sharks ended up at SeaWorld. But that I'm going to leave that for your rant, because I'm sure it's part of your rant. It's a nice, easy to watch popcorn movie.
Yeah, I agree. It's easy to watch.
If you're happy to switch off your brain, it's you know, you could just sit there and just let it all happen. And there is enough in it to keep you entertained. I didn't find any of it particularly boring. I didn't find it riveting, but I didn't find it as boring as you did. I love the campness of the water ski scenes. I think that was very enjoyable. And the 3D work, having said before, I've not seen the official 3D version because I don't have that equipment at home to watch it on the Blu-ray release. But yeah. We did both manage to acquire a copy each of an anaglyph rendering. So with the blue and red glasses, which we're assured is perfectly legit. I don't think it's a shonky copy. I don't know how it came to exist because I've been Googling to try and work out how this version exists and I can't work it out. But the guy that we got it from assures us it's all above board. So we have both watched it in a sort of 3D. And the 3D work, for the most part, is good. It is, you know, considering this is 40 years old. And, I did have to kind of sit slap bang in the middle of my sofa to watch it because even more than with polarized glasses, with the blue-red, you have to sit square onto the screen. Otherwise, yeah. Everything's a bit weird. And my eyes aren't particularly balanced anyway. So I always find it tricky watching 3D movies. But all of that taken into account, the 3D work, I watched it in 2D first. And I had quite a lot of, that's for 3D. Oh, that's for 3D. Oh, that's for 3D. And then when I watched it again in 3D, I was actually quite impressed the number of moments that I hadn't already identified as that will look good in 3D that did look good in 3D.
Yeah.
The issue is 3D was really inaccessible in 1983.
Yeah.
They made a movie. They put so much focus of the movie. This is leaning now into what I don't enjoy, but it will segue into your rant, I suppose. They put so much of this movie on the back of it being in 3D, but that's a format that was so inaccessible. You could see it in the cinema maybe once, maybe twice. If it's only running for 4 weeks, you're not going to have time or money to see it many more times than that. And then on TV, it was in 2D, so it looked shit. And when it came out to home release, which I'm sure it probably took a couple of years, but home release was just about to take off in 1983. So for home rental, you would have had to have watched it in 2D. So it would have looked shit. And I think that's where a lot of its negative reputation has come from, because it does look shit in 2D. There isn't enough to it. Once you take the 3D away, there's not enough left to hold up the movie, in my opinion. Hmm. Yeah. And the plot, you said that the premise is good, the execution of that into the plot is quite thin, and it's even by Jaws standards, it's so implausible that these two sharks would find themselves at SeaWorld. It don't make sense.
For me, it's like people have an issue with Jaws of Revenge about how the shark goes from Amity down to the Bahamas. My concern is in this film, how a 35-foot, the longest shark in any of the Jaws movies, it's like the size of two trucks, swims into the gate, past the observation window, and lowers itself into the air vent and stays there, and no one sees it, is beyond my ability to think, oh, that makes sense. It doesn't make sense. The fact that SeaWorld is not on the coast, it's in Orlando, that's an inland place for Florida. But I don't know how the shark got there in the first place. Maybe it was airdropped.
When I was reading about it, there was a thing that said that they did put an explainer in the movie of how it came to be.
The Caesar.
Yeah, but I don't remember. That didn't stick in my mind, that explainer.
In the movie, it goes SeaWorld.
Oh, okay, so they just changed US geography.
Yeah. What would be really annoying if you went to SeaWorld, because I went to SeaWorld with you, and at this point, you had not seen Jaws 3, because this was like, what, 15 years ago? Yeah, 15 years ago.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
And I was like, where's the Underworld Kingdom? Does not exist. The Underworld Kingdom does not exist. SeaWorld is not on the coast. So as a person who likes to visit film sets, this was complete utter bullshit.
I'm feeling quite lucky I escaped this rant at the time. I don't remember you say.
You don't remember me walking around going, where's the Underwater Kingdom? Where's the Underwater Kingdom?
No, I don't remember that. But then I didn't know why you were looking for it. So
this is true. There's no character development. Like even at the end of the film, you're like, who survived?
Oh yeah.
What happened after?
Yeah, that's
like, the other Jaws, the people in the observation counter, I'm like, well, the man got eaten, but then the woman got dragged off by the park owner. Mm. And you're like, did he survive? Did they survive?
It doesn't matter though, because the dolphins are okay.
I don't think this is an issue with this movie, but it stands an issue now with the producers of the Jaws movies. They went to the effort to give Mike Brody a marine biologist girlfriend in this movie, then made him a marine biologist in Jaws of Revenge, and gave him an artist girlfriend. And I just find that really confusing. I'm just like, what the hell's going on? And I know they're raising Jaws 3 with
Revenge completely discounts movie. Jaws 3, doesn't it?
But you're just like, they didn't write to think out of the box, did they? He could be a marine biologist.
Aside from the fact, if you had lived through Jaws and Jaws 2, why would you get a job that involves being anywhere near the water? Like, why? Yeah, I'm going to go and work at SeaWorld. I'm going to go and be a marine biologist. No, go and be a fucking accountant. And go somewhere that's complete. Yeah.
New York City.
Just keep dry.
Also, this movie did not need to be about the Brodies. This should have been what the original screenwriter wanted. This was their time to step away from the Brody family, focus on a new bunch of siblings somewhere else. You know, I think that the Chief Brody story was happily wrapped up at the end of Jaws 2. A lot of people would think it's wrapped up at the end of Jaws.
Yeah.
You know, I like Jaws 2, so I'm quite happy to keep 1 and 2 in their own little pocket. Jaws 3, for me, is where the franchise decided to take things in a weird direction.
Yeah, but I agree. I think if they're going to do that, if you're going to take it in a different direction, take it in a different direction. There's no need to link it to the Brodies. Yeah. And if you didn't refer to them by name, you wouldn't know it was the same people. There's so little reference to what's gone before.
Yeah.
And I guess now we know, because when he was writing it, he didn't want them to be those characters. So I guess he wrote it that way on purpose. But it doesn't need to be them. So why is it them? It would almost be better if it wasn't them.
No, exactly. Also, let's discuss the shark gliding towards the observation window. It does not move. It smiles before it hits the glass. So that glass shattering, it looks quite good in 3D.
Yeah, but in 2D, I was just like
the shock. Just,
what's this? This is the high terror moment of the movie. This is the climactic stunt.
It's just the fact of they didn't bother to try to make this shark wag its tail.
Wag its tail. It's not a dog.
Move its fins, but they did, move its tail, swim,
move. Try at to swim. All.
They made it glide, but as it got closer, it's when It just smiled, didn't it? It showed some teeth.
So weird.
It was kind of so like... weird. And do you know that there's a reason before... You know the reason... There is a reason why that looks so shit and why that exists in Hollywood history. So the company that they employed to make all the miniatures for Jaws 3 went into liquidation just as they were
running.
So they had all this miniatures done. And once again, Universal had their release date and they wanted to get that movie out in the marketplace. They didn't give a fuck what they shoved out. And having weaker people behind the cameras and people that probably are yes people more than arguing and passionately about their art like Spielberg did with the first movie and wouldn't rush it and they were overspent and they overshot, these people were willing to leave the studio. Yeah. And that is how we ended up with shit special effects in the last two Jaws movies. And the part of two as well was because the studio keeps getting involved. They want to make money. And that's the reason why we got those really shit special effects was because all the miniatures weren't finished.
And now it looks shit.
Very sad.
Just let people make movies. Yeah, I mean, this is the problem because, maybe they did it on purpose. They hired a bunch of people who don't have the pulling power to be able to call those kinds of shots. And to be able to tell the studio, no, I'm not going to do that. I want to make it right But it's a shame because the movie has then suffered.
There is. There's lots of documentaries about Jaws 3D on YouTube. There's also the original making of movie available. It's called Sharks Don't Die, the making of Jaws 3D. But it's like really something. Somebody's copied it from a TV recording. And it's
can't look worse than if you watch it on Jaws 3 in 2D, though, surely. Yes.
So, Claire, how many smiling mother sharks would you give Jaws 3?
Mummy shark, mummy shark. I'm going to give it... I'm going to give it 1.5. I was going to give it 1. Ooh. And that just feels really mean because I don't think I've ever given... I think I've given ones before. I haven't... It suddenly occurred to me nearly a year into making this podcast, I should probably have been making notes of what I've scored all these movies so that I don't have to listen back over episodes to make comparisons. I haven't done that. I'm not that organised. I don't know if I've ever given a 1 before, but I don't think I've ever given anything less than a 1 before. And it feels really mean to give a movie 1. And there are things I like in it. So I'm going to give it 1.5 out of 5. Do you know what? If it wasn't a Jaws movie, I would probably score it higher. If it was a standalone feature and it was just a killer shark movie, I think I would probably enjoy it more. And I've said this about other sequels before, that sometimes it just needs to be a movie in its own right. And I think this would be better if it was a movie in its own right, if it didn't have the Jaws name attached to it, because then you wouldn't have people's expectations. If it didn't have the Brodies in it, and you won't even need to take the Brodies out. You literally just change the names of those two characters, keep the script exactly the same, and it would make no difference. But it would make more sense, because otherwise you're thinking, well, why are these... I mean, with Sean, okay, he's just there for vacation. Why has Mike Brody gone into a career working at SeaWorld when he's got this, presumably quite traumatic past experience with sharks and with sea life? It's... I don't think it's a terrible movie, but I think it's a terrible Jaws movie. So I do appreciate that it needs the Jaws... If it didn't have the Jaws name, it probably wouldn't get people watching it in the first place, which is why the studios package it that way. But I think it would have been a better movie on its own. How about you?
I think, so for me, I'm a massive Jaws fan. This is my least favourite out of all. It's such a missed opportunity. And if they're going to go back and they said, like, let's remake a Jaws movie, out of all of them, I'd be like, remake Jaws 3, because I think today's standard and with today's special effects, they could actually make a really good movie about a killer shark in SeaWorld. It would be a phenomenal now, and I think it'd be a really big hit. Also, all the other Jaws movies, including Revenge, they're all very character development, and I've always liked that about the Jaws movies. I've always liked to know like how their characters develop from this shark impacting their life. And I just felt like you didn't get that from any of the characters in this. None of them had development. None of them had any progress of what people they were during the whole of this movie. I feel like it's just a real big missed opportunity. And for that reason, and as a disheartened Jaws fan from it, I would say I would give it 2 stars out of 5.
So that's Jaws 3D for you. Listeners, please take a moment to rate us and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. And tell us what you thought of Jaws 3D or Jaws 3 if you haven't been able to watch it in 3D. You can leave us a comment. You can email us on unlovedsequels@gmail.com. And you can find us on all the socials at unlovedsequels.
So it's goodbye from me, Michael.
And from me, Claire.
Take care, guys. Bye.
Our shark couldn't have killed Overman. Its mother did.
You're talking about the damn shark's mother?